Okay, we'll get started, but I guess I will hand out some handouts at the beginning. I don't think I quite have enough. So one is a repetition of Wednesday, which don't worry if you weren't here Wednesday, I'm going to fill in the blanks. So one is this little fun diagram I made, which we're going to actually talk through today. So this one is probably shareable. I think there's 20. And then another is, so that we'll use toward the beginning of today's session. And then another is a little page of provocative thoughts on the meaning of faith in light of mystery from the various thinkers that we've encountered this week. So I thought I would leave you, we're probably not going to go through these, there's too much text, but they're little nuggets that I might refer to so that we can use this session both as its own, focusing on its own content, but also looking retrospectively back at where we've been and what the various views of God and therefore faith have in common and what's distinct about each. So this one you can tuck aside till the end of the session. This is the one with the text versus the one with pictures. Now I better keep on with myself. Oh, and here's another one from the other day. So we can put that up in the peanut gallery.
Go!
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to begin our session with two sentences as meditative moments for us that will open up our topic for today. So, first thing I'd like to offer for your meditation is the following quotation by Soren Kierkegaard. It is a consoling idea that before God we are always in the wrong. And then something from 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4, which this is a translation by Christopher Stendhal, but it's pretty close to NRSV. And in this chapter 4, Paul is talking about the different approaches and divisions among the apostles, even, what their unique ministries are. And he's kind of refuting the notion that ministry to Jesus is sort of a zero-sum game, or that truth is a zero-sum game, that there's only just one approach. He calls that, actually, that view carnal, by which he means worldly, meaning not sort of from the perspective of faith. And so, even as he says that, though, one shouldn't think that he's espousing some kind of anything-goes position. And 1 Corinthians 4, verse 4, expresses this, and here's what it says. Paul says, I know that I am right, but I am not thereby justified. It is God who judges. Okay. So these two quotations I offer at the beginning, the one by Kierkegaard I would not encourage you to hear in kind of a penitential or self-deprecating way, that before God we're always in the wrong. He's not saying, well, you should sort of, you know, therefore lash yourself because humans are bad. And sort of formed by sin. He's saying it's consoling to remind ourselves that the human mind can never get to God on its own. It can never circumscribe God. And so even as we have the almost kind of the very loving, particular, even sort of a model of erotic love that you find in Kierkegaard's work in terms of faith in God, even as we have that heartfelt conviction about one's relationship with what he calls the Savior, it's also consoling to know in the presence of God, we don't have the truth. And again, in Paul, he says, yeah, I think I'm right. But, you know, it's God who judges. So this is kind of what I've been thinking about this week and what we're getting at when we think about religious pluralism and Christian attitudes of Christian faith toward religious pluralism. That how can one simultaneously, with conviction, cling to what one's heart holds dear and true from the perspective of faith, or as we quoted again, Christian Sandal on Wednesday, how can one sing a song with abandon to Jesus, right, without negating the songs of others who also sing from their heart to their true source of devotion? Okay, so So the first part of the session, I'm certain that I'm going to throw too much at you today, but it's my last day, so I want to both address the topic, but leave you with some food for thought, so apologies in advance, but take it as an opportunity to just soak up some ideas and leave with some food for thought. So today we've been thinking about the tension, but also the importance of two ideas. One, the idea that God is one, that Christians do confess in some sense a God who is God of the universe, and therefore that God's truth or redemption extends over all creation. And yet the importance of a particular perspective and embracing particularity as well, that ours is a unique faith and that the faith of others is a unique faith as well. And so confessing one's truth and also acknowledging the mystery of God that one can never completely control. And so today we're looking at the question of faith in relationship to religious pluralism. And I will, for just a couple minutes, revisit the model of pluralistic theology that we talked about last time that our thinker for that day was having some trouble with. Okay? And then I promised that I would tell you what his solution is. So the person we were looking at was named Mark Heim, and he wrote a book called Salvations, plural, Truth and Difference in Religion. And so he introduced us, and I won't dwell on this because you saw it already, to a typical problematic, he thinks, typology of thinking about Christian attitudes toward religions outside of Christianity. Okay? And one is an exclusivist view that there's only one truth, and it can only be found in the church or through faith in Jesus Christ. Then there's an inclusivist view that tries to say that people in other religions are saved through the all-encompassing grace of Christ. So there's still one truth, which is the grace of Christ, and all are saved by that, but people who don't acknowledge Christ are not excluded in the way that exclusivism suggests, but are included and encompassed in that universal grace of Christ. But so we talked about the some theologians' problems with this because it suggests that even if people don't want to be and don't know that they are saved by Christ, they are anyway. And so there's some theologians worry that there's a kind of colonialism or an imperialism in this gesture. And then there's a pluralistic view that says, well, there are all these different religions, but they're all going to the same place. And Mark Heim is not happy with any of these descriptions of the different possibilities for viewing other religions. Because he thinks, as we mentioned, that one could legitimately, within a particular tradition, at certain moments, think all of these things. Not one of them is terribly horrible or wonderfully good. Right? It may be true that, as we said, Jesus Christ is the only way to the Christian to salvation as Christians understand it. That's simply true. That's exclusive, yes, but that's true. There might be a moment at which one says that, right? And it's also true, again, that one may see genuine commonalities and see commonalities among salvations and think that there is a way in which one can say that either Christ's grace extends over all people. There's a moment in which it's okay to have robust universal or commitments or truths that have universal significance. And it's also important to recognize both similarities and differences and respect those as a pluralist view would offer. And so the model of pluralistic theology that we looked at, that Heim was unhappy with, was the model of John Hick, which is one side of your handout, your picture handout, okay? And in this model, it's sort of the view of pluralism, okay? So it's the idea that there's one truth or one ultimate transcendent reality that no one knows in itself. It's beyond human conception. And that all the different religions are leading to that same path, each in their own way. And Heim was unhappy with this because he thought that it didn't really recognize the distinctiveness of different religions. It says that, well, they're all talking about the same thing, they're all going to the same place. It also doesn't really require any genuine risk in terms of faith, because it doesn't really matter, ultimately, which faith you espouse in this view, right? Because they're all sort of the same or ending up in the same place. Okay, and so this is kind of a lazy relativism that he's worried about, this thinker, Mark Heim, who we're thinking of today. Okay, And so what we talked about was that Haim wants to come up with a way that one can simultaneously robustly affirm one's particular Christian faith in its fullness with a strong claim of conviction, but also respect that the particularity of others, that others will simultaneously, reciprocally be making the same claim within their own particular tradition. And how can one come up with a model for thinking about this, but also a model that he thinks draws on Christian tradition and is rooted in the history of Christian theology? Okay. Am I going way too fast for those of you who are here on this? With me a little bit?
Yeah,
okay. All right. So we're almost getting to where we wanted to be. So here's what Mark Haim wants to say. He wants to say, let's try to respect the particularity of each religion, and let's not insist that all religions are seeking the same goals or ends or notions of fulfillment. And this is, again, what he thinks this typology can't do. And this typology assumes that there's only one salvation. Okay? You either don't have it, or yours conquers everyone else, or you're all going for the same thing. So here's his, as we said, saw before, his job description for a better pluralistic theology rooted in a Christian confessional theology. Okay. So first of all, again, he doesn't want to claim that his theory is neutral. He's not interested in neutrality because he thinks no one has neutrality. Right? One is always situated. One is always informed by the loyalties that one holds dear with one's heart, that which one has faith in. But that one's own notion of truth. Okay, he wants to also then engage religions on their own terms. So again, respect and really listen to the distinctiveness of other religions, and not subsume them under your own definition of religion, or pretend that your definition of religion is somehow generic and fits them all. Make sure that there's some clear point to engaging with honesty and conviction and risk another person from another person of faith, from another faith tradition. And here's one of his distinctive points. Be open to multiple religious fulfillments. So what would it mean to say that there are multiple salvations or multiple ends or goals? Okay. Here he's really holding in tension two claims that he wants to say one can hold at the same time. And that is, number one, that religious truth is one. And that religious aims and fulfillments are various. So religious truth is one would be kind of an urge toward a kind of monotheistic view of faith. But religious aims or truths are various would be, we could say, sort of a polytheistic notion. How can one simultaneously hold these two claims without contradiction? That's something he's interested in. Don't disallow uniqueness claims. So just like Paul says, I think I'm right. I think this faith I espouse is true, right? And this is unique in the grace of Christ that we experience in this tradition. Don't disallow those kinds of claims. Have your own and respect those of others. And also allow some religious positions to be wrong. So again, not a lazy relativism that says everything is okay. Each according to their own perspective, regardless of any kind of criterion for judging a perspective. Because he's also interested in the topic of how the relation among the world religions or questions about religious pluralism often lead people to questions about religious violence and also to questions of social justice in the world, he wants to again relate a theory to questions about how a theory of religious pluralism can contribute to justice concerns in the world. And then he says, I want you to tell me how your view of the relation among the religions could be said in strong and rich theological terms. So give me a theology. Don't give me a generic theory of religion. Give me a theology and a Christian theology. Okay. So let's look at, we looked at his generic way of thinking about how there could be many different fulfillments. We're not going to look at that today because it's not important for our purposes. But let's look at his chart that says God is Trinity at the top. Okay. So Haim has a Christian theory of the relation among the religions. The picture one? Is there enough that there's some, I don't have, is there someone near you who can share? Or, do you guys have one at all that you could share? Or if your neighbor has one, can you give it to someone who doesn't? So everyone can see it. Okay, so here we have a view of a notion that the Trinitarian dynamism, or he calls the divine plenitude of God, as imagined and confessed in Christian tradition, can be an interesting way of thinking about the relation among the religions. Okay, so you have a notion here of, not as with Hick, where there's this transcendent real that no one knows, right, at the top. At the top of Hines is God as Trinity. So the uniqueness of Christian faith, among many things, many possibilities, is that Christians confess faith in the God who is triune. And therefore, for Christians, salvation could be seen as communion with that triune God. So communion with that triune God is, as you'll see, closest to the top, which is God as Trinity. So a Christian, from the perspective of faith, within Christian theology, could say, well, look, there's a divine plenitude, the richness and vastness and internal intricacy of God's work and presence in creation is beyond what we could possibly expect. We're surprised by it. It's mysterious. It's beyond the scope of what we could know. And as a Christian, one can confess that communion with that triune God is, according to the conviction of one's own heart and faith, truth or salvific for you. But you'll see that one could also recognize the distinctiveness of other religions, and also that those could be encompassed in this divine plenitude. Okay, so look at the chart. So we've got Christianity, and I've got, if you look at the bottom of the chart, religion B, religion C, religion D, and then I have a very specific, instead of one other generic one, I have Buddhism as an example, okay? So what do you see going on? Remember, Markheim wants there to be multiple, he calls it salvations, but what he means is different ends toward which religions are moving or seeking, different notions of human fulfillment, okay? So what do you see going on here? How is he preserving difference among religion? Is he living up to his job description? Is he preserving the particularity of traditions? Is he preserving the a kind of normative perspective that grounds his vision of the relation among the religions in not only Christian theology, but Christian faith? Talk with your neighbor for a minute about what you think this chart represents, okay? And then we'll work it out together. What is his point, and what does the chart say? Okay, so one way to get at this question is, what's the difference, if it doesn't seem too dizzying to look at both charts? What are some of the differences between these two charts?
The ultimate end.
Okay.
Or the highest.
Okay.
Whereas, you know, in time, God is Trinity, our Christian view is that looks appears to be the highest point or the ultimate point.
Okay.
Whereas that's not necessarily true.
Okay. So this is not trying to be generic somehow, right? So the highest point is the triune God, and the highest form of salvation is communion with the triune God, from the perspective of Christian faith.
Well, that's what we were wondering. If I was not a Christian, Buddhist writing it, if I were a Buddhist, from his view, if I were a Buddhist writing this, could Nirvana be at the top?
Well, I think you have to have a whole different theory.
Okay.
Because it's not, this is not a generic theory of the relation among the religions. This is a Christian theological constructive proposal for how to use the doctrine of the Trinity to think about religious pluralism. So he'd say, well, I don't know. I mean, a Buddhist would have to draw on its own, on his or her own scriptures and teachings and the wisdom of different lineages and come up with their view of what the relation among the world religions is. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Because for Hick, probably any, you know, well, actually nothing could be at the top except that mystery is real. But that's actually very clarifying.
So what else is different about the two charts? So in one, that which is highest is generic, okay? And in other, it's very specifically the triune God. Yeah?
I think like the title of his book, he's allowing, like, you can get to the divine plenitude different ways, and there are different ends that are equally as valid.
Right. Good. So there's not one notion or model of salvation here. Now, there is one that's regarded as the highest from his Christian theological perspective, right? So in his model, the salvation is the same thing. All the different religions, each in their own way, are going toward reality-centeredness, or right, self-sacrificing concern for the good of others. Right? So turning away from self and toward that which is mysterious and ultimately real. So there's one notion of salvation in Hick's model. And all the religions are getting there except those who don't pass that ethical criterion by which he judges the religions. Right? Those that don't offer self-sacrificing concern to others. But here, there's multiple notions of salvation. Now, you may think, oh, there's not. So let's sit with that tension. Let's say how there are multiple notions of salvation.
Well, first of all, we can see that Christianity has a couple, he
wants us to see diversity within traditions, too. We can't address that now. But that's why I have three lines coming out of Christianity. There's more than that, obviously. So different forms of Christian faith and Christian theology might both, in what he thinks is sort of the best or highest way, proclaim a kind of salvation that is communion with God. But the other religions are not going for communion with God. They're, you know, religion B is going toward end B, or salvation B, or fulfillment B. Religion C is going toward fulfillment C, right? Religion D is going toward end or fulfillment D, and Buddhism is going toward Nirvana. It's not going for communion with God. So he's recognizing a diversity of religious fulfillments or ends. So there's that radical particularity and uniqueness that he wants to honor and respect. He's not saying, well, you're saying the same thing I am. We're both talking about the same thing in the unique language of our culture or something. Like, no, you're actually talking about something different than I am. He's saying to the Buddhist or the religion C or the religion B person. And you'll see with religion B and C, there's some overlapping history and claims and convictions that shows maybe the commonality or the inclusivist impulse sometimes within religious traditions. But does anyone have trouble with what I just said?
I do.
Good. That's what I was hoping.
Well, the way Hines has depicted this, he eliminates the possibility that any other religion would be in communion with God. Mm-hmm. And that I'm open to that possibility. So I don't know that it is, but I think we've got to be open to that possibility.
Well, what do you mean by that exactly? I mean, I think he thinks the other religions are part of the divine fullness and richness.
Right.
So they are, in that sense, connected to God as he
Right, but as he's using the phrase communion with God, he's eliminated any possibility that another religion could be in communion with God as he's defined it.
Okay. I think what he means by that is Christian salvation. That's how he defines Christian salvation, that one sort of returns to the love of the love between the persons of the Trinity kind of after death, right? That one comes from God's love and returns to God's dynamic love. And I think he's saying, yeah, I think so. In some sense, he wouldn't say, well, I don't think that other religious traditions have any relationship to God or have any relationality with God or communion with the sort of small c, right? But he is saying that, I don't think that other religions are,
well, yeah, why is he saying that they're not, it's not that they just,
is it because no other religion believes in the Trinity in the way that Christians do?
That's one piece of it. Good. So one part of it is he's trying to respect the engaged religions on their own terms. He's saying, well, yeah, I mean, I believe my Muslim neighbor when he says, I'm not seeking communion with the triune God. That's completely antithetical to the oneness of God that is paramount for Islam, right? And so he's saying, I'm not going to say that that's what you're doing, because you've told me that that's not what you're doing. That's not what you seek. That's not what you confess. And therefore, presumably you're not going there, maybe? I don't know. So one is to respect that there are genuine differences. Okay. Yeah.
What does he lose by not putting God as Trinity in his part of divine plenitude, as one of the divine plenitudes?
Right.
I think
it does.
In which case we learn from each other. We may assume that the Buddhist has some insights that are not within Christianity, but that we might learn.
Okay. Why? Say more about that. I think that. Tell
maybe
me more
it's
about
because
what you want
you'd be sacrificing the claim neutrality part.
Mm-hmm.
He is who he is,
mm-hmm.
and so that for his purposes, that's why that bubble is on top.
But I think he does want to say that he. And we'll talk about that in a couple slides. He does want to say that a Christian not only has to enter the dialogue with firm conviction about their own particular uniqueness, but also with the possibility that they could be wrong and they could be changed. Like there has to be risk involved in religious. I mean, not that there's
not necessarily right or wrong, but new insight.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
New insight.
That one could gain some kind of new insight. He does want that. But you feel like something about this picture doesn't allow
well,
that.
He's still got the hierarchy.
So. Okay, good. So there's a hierarchy. Good. So this is the other thing. I think what's really just coming over here. It's not just that the Buddhist isn't reaching communion with God because the Buddhist says the Buddhist isn't going for communion with God. It's also that he's saying that, well, as a Christian, I think that the goal of another tradition is not as high as my goal. And it sounds like, kind of like a weird way of saying it.
This says is that he looked at all the rules and so forth of all these other religions, and this is what he thought, this was the end of it. They don't do these things.
Mm-hmm.
That's all this says to me,
mm-hmm.
in black and white.
But if you'll notice, though, that the different circles that are the religious fulfillments, they're, again, as of last time, some are higher than others. And apologies again for the horizontal metaphor about truth, that somehow being at the top is highest or something. But it's just a way of representing that one could recognize the validity among many particularities. But yeah, you might have a hierarchy of value if you're committed to a certain conception of truth. Right? Many things are true. And some things are truer or more valuable than others. They're all valuable, and some things actually might be wrong, which is what we have for religion D. Religion D is not part of the divine plenitude. Okay? So he's coming up with this, I mean, I think this, I hope this, I realize this picture could be kind of alienating because it's very, I don't know, it's very objectifying or something, but he's trying to come up, and this is my rendering of what I read in one of his chapters. He didn't draw this chart, but short of reading it aloud. It's my summary of his model, okay? So he wants the possibility for you to say, well, yes, some religious viewpoints, even within Christianity, whatever, if you're Christian, could be just wrong. You might think that as a person of faith. Right? And you might think that, wow, there is wisdom and truth in that neighboring religion. It's not the truth that I give my ultimate loyalty to, but it has a lot of value, and I regard it as mysteriously part of the divine plenitude, but I don't regard it as that which I have faith in, and that what I see as kind of the highest or the truest or the profoundest or the deepest. Yeah?
So why does certitude in my own faith necessarily mean there's got to be a hierarchy?
Mm-hmm.
I just don't see that that's necessitates that, that I can be very certain in my own, and
okay.
this person can be certain in theirs, and that doesn't make mine that's sort of higher on
okay.
the rightness level.
I like that, that's good. Responses?
Yeah. I notice religion C kind of wanders around, but
mm-hmm.
I like that the Christianity, it's interesting he didn't have a Christianity just kind of wandering around, but I think if you wander around too much tasting everything, you lose track of what is really mm-hmm. important. I think mm-hmm. something has to be important enough
mm-hmm.
to want to go there.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's kind of the answer, and it might not be what's important to somebody else, but
mm-hmm.
as Christians, I think, personally, there's something that needs to be most important to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or I'll wonder.
Even
yeah.
if it's not certitude, because I'm with you. Like,
yeah, I'm uncomfortable with certitude,
right.
too.
Mm-hmm.
Which doesn't mean I'm uncomfortable with
right.
profound devotion and
right.
conviction and something you're sort of
right.
taking your life on in some way.
Right. Right. Yeah.
It would depend on how you're using the word certitude. I use a word like boundaries. We all at some point there's a boundary.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise we're just
yeah.
up there. So now you may say, I know those boundaries are likely to become idolatrous if I make them too hard.
Mm-hmm.
But they are boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And that so if you slip this chart and you put the bubble over on the left hand side or the right hand side of the Trinity, you
mm-hmm.
still have the same issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's just you'd be
disposing right.
of the language of hierarchy.
Right.
We wouldn't have a vertical metaphor, but we'd still have boundaries.
So you're saying that there wouldn't be much of a, we still would come up against the same conundrum.
I think we'd get rid of the pejorative hierarchy.
Okay. I actually resonate with that, and that's why I think Heim's book is really smart and interesting and theologically rich. That is also one of the things that I sort of personally don't resonate with in his work. But I'll just tell you one little thing here, which I'll just go ahead toward a couple of slides. He wants to, and then I'll get to these two comments over here. Heim actually is an interesting theologian. He comes from and actually remains in an evangelical Christian theological background. He teaches at Andover Newton Theological Seminary, and he was raised in an evangelical version of Christianity and still belongs to that. He is what we could call a very liberal evangelical. But for him, he has two moments that are really important to him in his model of faith. And one is this notion of kind of acceptance of propositions. This would be more like religious commitment as akin to belief. Some of us probably do resonate with that, and some of us, like, I actually don't resonate with that as much. I'm not afraid of truth claims, but I don't think of belief as the primary synonym for faith myself. But I think for a lot of people that is important, that there's a sense in which religious commitment involves different moments. And some moments are, some people would say, well, to believe something or to profess something is to negate something else. And it sounds like maybe in the back, I'm not sure whether you're comfortable with that or not, or to negate.
No, I just don't like the idea of hierarchy.
Yeah, higher.
In the evaluation
mm-hmm.
of others' religions.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Yeah. So he thinks that if you just go with number one, it's a bummer because then it's very conflict oriented in terms of the relation among the religions, and there is always going to be a right or a wrong, right? But he's also worried about if you define religious commitment only as number two, kind of the sort of not as kind of propositional, not as about like do you believe that claim X is true, right? But more like the faith and the sensibility that you gain through ritual, through liturgy, through community life, through the kind of body knowledge of faith, through the emotions you gain, through participation in a tradition over time, and the sort of sense of existential meaning and existential devotion. Those are important aspects of what faith is too. But he says if you only go with two, he says, I'm worried that you're just going to fall into a kind of relativism that doesn't really confront both your own particularity and its implications and someone else's particularity
mm-hmm.
and what they're saying to you. So he kind of wants to have both of these things. And so I think it's part of number one that makes him kind of, and his evangelical background, that does make him want to think about sort of notions of truth in a more robust way that sometimes focuses on a certain kind of certainty that some may or may not resonate with. I think probably there's a lot of diversity in this room right now. It's fine. So there were a couple comments over here. Is it, are we, that you wanted to offer about observations of his model, or?
Oh, it was just that I'm not sure if it's relevant, but I'm just sort of curious, like, what the other ends could be, like, you know, salvation, nirvana, like, what are some mm-hmm. other things that could be, and I'm not sure if that's really relevant.
Yeah, well, I think he would say that however the goal or the notion of religious fulfillment is defined within a particular tradition, it's in its own doctrinal sources and heritage.
Right, I'm just curious what those might be.
I think that's too broad of a question. Yeah. But there, that would be to look very specifically, what the different religions espouse. But of course, each religion has a whole host of diversity within it. So, but good question. But you'll see that, for example, he acknowledges that Christians view salvation differently, and he thinks that, well, from my perspective, it might be okay for me as a certain kind of Christian, meaning Mark Heim, not meaning Lord Pearson, but to think that, well, other Christians are defining salvation in terms that are less oriented on this communion with the triune God idea. I have respect toward those that are my brothers and sisters within Christianity. I don't agree with their notion of salvation, but I recognize it again as part of the divine plenitude. It's not that they're completely wrong, right? So, but that it's a different notion of salvation, that one can have the conviction of one's own definition of salvation and recognize it as different from someone else in your tradition, and even of lesser value. Okay, again, here's this hierarchical language. But I think that, I'm not sure we can avoid hierarchical language. I mean, I think there has to be a hierarchy of values that we all, maybe that's not getting at what your problem was, but I feel like if we have, that we all recognize multiple goods, but we don't rank those goods as equally valuable. Right, we have a relative hierarchy among the different goods that we see in our life, for example, or in the world around us. Right? I mean, part of that does relate to the notion that God is creator, right? And that all it is good.
Right? And that's
but maybe
make
in terms of human fulfillment, you know,
well,
some
we
things.
We make choices. I mean, we can't do everything and be everything. We have to choose something.
And some things we think might provide more fulfillment or are worthy of loyalty more than other things, and the other things are therefore not demonized. They're still good. We would not say about everything, right? But there can be a hierarchy of goods that we are seeking or that we live in terms of our values. That
is that personal, or is it one that you can, you know, it's that notion of ultimate truth.
Mm-hmm.
Is that my personal hierarchy of goods,
mm-hmm.
or is that
good?
Objective.
Well, I'm interested in the thing number, have a clear purpose for interreligious dialogue, because if you have a hierarchy, doesn't your purpose end up being trying to get other people to your...
All right.
Yeah, exactly.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you, this is a good transition, I'm going to skip ahead for a few slides, but one of the things I wanted to ask you, which gets at this question, is... what's the similarity between these two charts? And I will just tell you the answer because we're going to they both are inclusivist. Okay, so in other words, they both subsume other religions in some ways, not maybe completely or in a horribly imperialistic, violent way, but they do have a universal kind of scope to them, right? Hicks says, well, all religions are going for the nice liberal religious end that I think is the generic truth about all religions, right? So he's an inclusivist too, right? Because he's subsuming all religions under one model of salvation. And so is Heim. Okay, but here's the difference. I mean, this is probably not true to Hick because I also like it in his own way for his own reasons, but Heim says, I know and I'm admitting that. I'm not pretending to be neutral. Hick thinks he's coming up with a generic theory of religion, but it's actually inclusivist, right? And so that's why he thinks if you claim that you're neutral, but you're not, then he's worried about the I don't mean violence in the literal way, but the violence that you do to other people's particularity, right? And Haim says, no, no, no. I know that I have an inclusivist vision. After all, I'm a certain kind of Christian. I think that, you know, God is, you know, creator, redeemer, sustainer of all that is, seen and unseen. Yes, I do think that there is, there, as he says, a providential, or that somehow God's salvation does extend over all that is. I don't think that therefore all the religions are the same. But there is, he thinks, kind of a providential provision of diverse religious ends, but they're all seen within that notion of God as a dynamic trinity. But again, he's saying, but that's because I'm grounding my proposal in Christian theology and I'm not trying to be neutral. Because if I can, with honesty, admit that there is a valid inclusivist moment in Christian theology, it's not the only valid moment, but there is a way in which people can say that that God's grace, as known in Christian through Christ, is so all-encompassing and mysterious and gracious and gratuitous that it does encompass everything, right? That's an inclusivist move, right? Go ahead.
Well, I'm just a little confused because since he was raised as a Christian, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's never really like experienced another type of religion. Isn't he kind of saying like, this is my favorite type of food when he's only tried one type of food?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Know, like, how can he put this at the top mm-hmm. with certainty when he's
yeah.
never like, tried,
yeah,
like,
good,
Buddhism?
Good. Yeah, I'm not sure he'd want to. I think that's good. I mean, I don't know the answer for sure, but I feel like it wouldn't be fair to say that he's claiming absolute certainty.
Okay.
I think he's trying to speak confessionally and robustly from the position of Christian faith as he understands it. But I don't think he's saying that I have the view from nowhere and I've objectively evaluated and experienced all the richness of all these traditions and now I know which one is the best. I think he thinks that would not be possible. That I mean, I think he respects particularity enough and the kind of ways in which we're sort of shaped and informed by our traditions that sort of shopping around at different ones wouldn't really be a genuine option. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I just feel like if he goes into like an interreligious dialogue with this viewpoint,
mm-hmm.
then he's not going to really be open to the fact that other people
Good.
Have a different.
Good, except that he thinks he is, so let's see why.
I have a question about the firm conviction piece.
Yeah.
I, in looking at that as a lay person
mm-hmm.
who wants to have interreligious dialogue about how
mm-hmm.
we're alike, how we're different, I heard firm conviction as being sure you know what you're talking about
mm-hmm.
when you talk about Christianity,
mm-hmm.
not I am right.
Right.
And because I do think sometimes a lot of people who speak on behalf of Christianity are very muddy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it isn't really clear what the convictions are
mm-hmm.
or if those convictions represent Christianity.
So you're saying this might justify or defend or rationalize sort of irresponsible kind of exclusive truth claims on the part of anyone, whether they know what they're talking about or whether they've been very reflective or that, is that what you're saying?
No, I really think that it's being, I don't think that was my intent. My intent more was that if I was going to speak to someone of another
mm-hmm.
religion about where I came from and what my faith was,
mm-hmm.
I needed to simply be sure of what that faith was for me and how it was based. How Christianity,
mm-hmm.
what the firm pieces of Christianity were that I was speaking from.
Mm-hmm.
Not that, it had nothing to do with
okay.
with other
so
Christians that,
mm-hmm.
I mean, somebody who is very different from me as a Christian could have firm convictions and come from that perspective
yes.
and talk about this. I'm not demeaning that.
Okay.
I just think we are very muddled often
mm-hmm.
in terms of what we say
mm-hmm.
because we're not thinking theologically. That's not our day-to-day
mm-hmm.
routine, thinking
mm-hmm.
from a theological perspective about what our faith is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, good. I think that's a good point. I mean, I think that Haim would want to, even though he is really kind of proposing a very doctrinal and theologically specific model, I think he wants to create a model that simply honors people's particularity and invite people into the conversation without saying that they have to check their convictions at the door,
right.
And that they can genuinely learn from others, and they can take a risk, and maybe they'll learn that something that they thought was mistaken somehow, right, or could be enriched by something else, or et cetera.
I agree.
So, yeah. So let's just read a couple of these things. So he says, Christians can confirm, and he says, is the possibility of providential provision of a diversity of religious sense for human beings. That's kind of what the chart is representing. And he says, the alternativeness of these ends and other traditions to Christian aims allows and even requires a judgment from the Christian perspective that subordinates them to the consummation of the Christian life. Okay, so that's where he feels that, that again, that one has to allow uniqueness claims and not he doesn't want people to sort of say that they have to be a relativist in relationship to other religions. Not that all that religions aren't all equally valid or religious positions. And we shouldn't say religions, because I think even within Christianity he would say that not all Christian positions are equally valid. Okay, to realize something other than communion with the triune God and with others in the continuing relationship of created being is to achieve a lesser good. There's no reason to avoid this judgment as long as we grasp that others make reciprocal judgments. So you're not therefore disallowing, because that's what he thinks gonna gonna get you to the more genuine encounter. And that's where I think the humility and the lack of certitude comes in, right? That the best and most fruitful and most transformative and challenging in a good way approach to talking to a person of another faith is to bring your particularity and your uniqueness and fully expect that they're bringing their particularity and their uniqueness reciprocally to you, right? Okay, and so witness to others and attentive openness to their witness turn out to be intimately related. Do you agree?
Still not convinced it places people on an even playing field at all.
Okay, good.
I have a problem with that. I have a whole problem with the word judgment.
Good.
I wanted to change it to viewpoint.
Okay.
Because we have different viewpoints.
Nice. Yeah. So. I think that's good. And I hope that, I mean, actually the thinkers that I presented to you this week. And also in using Hick as kind of a foil against Haim or a contrast, there's a lot in Hick that's really rich and valuable. And Haim actually sees himself as kind of drawing on a lot of Hick's model, but changing it in ways that fit some of what is valuable to him as a person.
Yes.
Right? Someone like Gordon Kaufman would have some similarities and some real problems with what Haim is saying. So I totally affirm that. I'm not trying to present this as the truth.
I know.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
Know.
So that's I think that's
but
good.
I personally have problems.
The word judgment seems closed. I have made a judgment, and you have made a judgment, and my worry is that conversation would be, this is what I think, well, this is what I think. Bye now.
End of story.
Right. Yeah. Rather than bringing an open, in the third paragraph, he talks about openness, which is different than judgment, it seems
yes.
to me. It's like,
witness
or discernment seems like a more open-ended word.
Good.
Judgment seems closed and final.
Yeah, good, yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking that even that last sentence in the middle one there, though, he's not writing a book, and then that's done with it, now I go on to the next project. This whole thing seems to me to be very conversational. It's constant. It keeps on. This is not a project that's done.
Yeah.
It keeps on. This is mm-hmm. partly the religious human project and the Christian project is this. You do, well, if the word judgment doesn't work, then it's maybe not worth using.
Mm-hmm.
But as I read, these judgments aren't, okay, I'm done with you.
Exactly,
it's,
good.
It's always conversation.
Yeah.
Perception as another word for judge instead of judgment. We come at things with certain perceptions, which may or may not be correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, and maybe the idea of an interfaith dialogue where I say the idea of the incarnation is a really important part of my faith, and a God who came down and became human is just central to how I understand God. And then they say, oh, and what's really central to me is the idea of submission. You know, maybe that's a richer dialogue than just talking about, oh, we're all headed towards, you know,
good.
Doing good in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe that's a better interfaith dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's nice. And that's true. I mean, I think that Haim does, even though you don't see it in what I've presented as much, he does also, akin to some of the thinkers that we've encountered, like Gordon Coffin, like Elizabeth Johnson, really value the idea of the mystery of God, right? And to not be presumptuous in the face of the mystery of God. Right? So there is this kind of, as Coffin would say, relativizing moment in his theology where he recognizes that he doesn't have kind of the corner of the market or the view from nowhere kind of on truth. And that's why I think he says that, though, by saying, look, I'm not trying to be neutral. By that, I mean he doesn't think that his view is objective, and therefore he doesn't think it's like the final truth forever and ever for all generic human beings, amen, or something, right? He's saying, this is particular. This is my particular identity and heritage and tradition and the confessions that we make, and they're who I am, is what he would say. Again, we may not all relate to that as much in the room and have that much of a kind of strong sense of identity that he seems to have. Yeah.
So, and I don't want to get us too far on another track, but I couldn't help wonder if there, what's the application in some ways, and is there an mm-hmm. intra-religious dialogue that mm-hmm. can and should take place based on some of these theories?
That's a good point, yeah. He doesn't address that except for that he does have a whole chapter on diversity within traditions and how he tries to account for that. But his goal in this book is interreligious dialogue, but that's probably equally, if not more, important.
Well, and the difference between doctrine or the action of leadership versus mm-hmm. The theologies as presented, and mm-hmm. where do we go wrong? Mm-hmm. Doctrinally or in action within our faith.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good. Since we're coming to an end, I wanted to, let's see, I think I'll just try to give you just I'm not going to go through this now except for just to tell you what to look for in these different quotations if you've got one. And then I'll end again with, something from, Christer Sandel's interpretation of Paul, something from 1 Corinthians again to leave us with. So we've encountered conceptions of God that focus on God's mystery. And this, by the way, there's two books in the bookstore if you're interested in reading more of Kaufman. There's God, Mystery, Diversity, and In the Beginning, Creativity. I didn't order them, but I just so happened to have had them, so if you're interested. This one's actually from the library. It's here. So we've encountered the idea that God in God's self is a mystery and can never be circumscribed by our language or domesticated by our notions of God. And yet the importance for using language for God and thinking about the symbol of God. And so Gordon Kaufman kind of directed our activity to our reflection to a very constructive notion of theology and of faith, that the task of theology is to think critically about the symbols of God, right, that we come up with, and to see how those have implications in terms of his particular concern with sort of environmental issues and ecological issues. But he certainly has a notion of faith as not that which one believes literally in, but that focuses human devotion, right? It's kind of that which one calls one's center of value, or that which is the highest object of devotion, or the most valuable object of devotion toward which one's life is directed, right? So a sense of faith as a center of value. So I've got a little quotation here about Kaufman on devotion to God and what that means and what faith might mean. We also encounter Johnson, who also affirms God's divine incomprehensibility, but sees the needs for many names for God, including especially female language for God, to address certain kinds of concerns about injustice toward women and working for more justice with respect to gender relations. We then encounter James Cohn, who also affirms the mystery of God, but speaks in radically particular terms in thinking of God as black. And this has comes then to
becomes to kind of confess God as black in that particularity, precisely to join in that liberationist struggle that he was addressing in 1969. Okay, and then today we talked about Mark Heim on Christian Faith and Religious Poems. And there's just a few tastes here of the different thinkers, and how I tried to not only talk about how they define God, but also how they define faith. So that's for some reflection at home. And I think that that I wanted to end with a little vision from Paul, but again, a wonderful way of interpreting Paul that Christopher Stendhal offers, who I talked about the other day. So this is from 1 Corinthians 15, and Paul is describing in different ways the last days, or the resurrection of the dead, the end times. Okay. And let's see, what was it? Christopher Stendhal offers a reflection on chapter 15, verse 28. And here's the actual verse. When all things are subjected to him, meaning God, then the Son himself will also be subjected to the one who put all things in subjection under him, so that God may be all in all. I'll read it again. When all things are subjected to God, then the Son himself will also be subjected to the one who put all things in subjection under him, so that God may be all in all. Okay. And here's a vision that Christopher Stendhal offers that I think relates to our conversation today. He says, he's talking about one of his favorite passages in the Bible is 1 Corinthians 15, around that verse that I read. He said, it is the day of consummation that Paul's reflecting on, and the whole world is gathered, and there we are, we Christians. Now, as we look up, there is God and Christ on God's right hand, exactly as we have been told. So we turn around and see that there are also all the others. We see a sort of pan-religious and ecumenical representation, and we turn around with a Christian smile which says, you see, it's just as we said. Isn't it wonderful that our God is so generous that you can all be here? He says, when we turn back toward God, there is no Christ to be seen on God's right side, because Christ will never be present to feed into the smugness of his believers. Or, as the text says, and here's his translation, and so when the end comes, Christ will lay it all down before the Father, and God will become all in all. That is another way of witnessing to the mystery, lest I be conceited. Thank you for this wonderful evening.